I'm here with Peter Sjostedt Hughes, who is a philosopher of mind and metaphysics and the co-editor and contributor of Bloomsbury's Philosophy and Psychedelics, which was published in 2022. He specializes in the thought of Whitehead, Nietzsche, and Spinoza, and in fields pertaining to panpsychism and altered states of consciousness. He's a lecturer at the University of Exeter, where he also teaches on psychedelics and philosophy. So, Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Ali. Good to be here.
So it's an interesting time to be talking about psychedelic philosophy because it is the 70th anniversary of The Doors of Perception, Aldous Huxley's sort of monumental and very influential book on psychedelic philosophy, among other things. So I thought we could start there, and it might be interesting to hear, you know, what is the legacy of that book?
Yeah, well, that was a book written, published then in 1954 about his mescaline experiences. The interesting thing for me as a philosopher about it is that it talks a bit about his experience, it then goes into the philosophical framing of that. And, you know, Huxley, as is his general style, he uses loads of different things, but in that book, he actually suddenly goes into the philosophy of Henri Bergson, and tries to sort of understand the mescaline experience in terms of Bergson's philosophy, using two main tenets, mind at large and the reducing valve. And that, I don't know if that really did have a larger legacy in philosophy, because, you know, Bergson was really popular in the early 20th century, but then sort of in the 1930s, 40s, after the wars, he became less and less popular. Bertrand Russell criticized him quite badly, unfairly in my view. And so that kind of Bergsonian view wasn't really popular in philosophy, academic philosophy circles. And then generally, I think psychedelia kind of turned away from philosophy a little bit. You know, philosophy, the interesting stuff about philosophy for psychedelics, I think, is metaphysics, like Bergson's metaphysics. But metaphysics was kind of, in the 20th century, kind of a bad word, you know, consciousness was a bad word. And so we didn't really engage with psychedelics in a Western philosophical view. What people did instead, what Huxley did to a certain extent, is drew from the East, you know, so Vedanta, Buddhism, Taoism, and stuff like that. Tibetan Book of the Dead with Leary, of course. But so the philosophical legacy hasn't been great. But I think now, when we've sort of re-entering so-called psychedelic renaissance on one side, and we've re-entered the metaphysical renaissance or the metaphysical turn on the other, we can start looking at that again.
Yeah, and I want to dive into metaphysics a bit in a moment. There's two things you just mentioned there, which I think are interesting. The reducing valve and the mind at large, because I think these ideas are still prevalent in psychedelia and potentially a crossover with the neuroscience of psychedelics as well. But maybe you could talk a bit about what was Huxley's idea about the reducing valve?
Well, the reducing valve was a term, I mean, it means in a water pipe, a sort of tap that just reduces the flow of water, the pressure of water. And the idea was, and this he drew both from Vedanta, Indian Vedanta, and Bergson, the idea was that instead of the normal view today, which is that the brain generates consciousness, produces consciousness, rather the view is that the brain actually filters consciousness into something that is practicable for human life, for practical flourishing, as it were. And that's Bergson's philosophy. You know, the brain cannot produce, but it rather receives and channels or filters consciousness. That's a reducing valve. And it can mean a number of, I mean, for Bergson, it means two general things. It means we reduce the external sensibility. So we can't see infrared, ultraviolet, of course. We can only see a small fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum. I think that's pretty, most people would agree with that. But there's more to it in Bergson. So he also thinks that we filter memory as well. So we only sort of remember that which is useful to us at the moment. But Bergson's theory of memory is that, because consciousness is not produced by the brain, nor is memory. So memory exists, as it were, out there. It's never lost. Access to it is lost. So that's a reducing valve, basically the external world and memory. What is reduced ultimately then? What is this great pressure that is reduced in the valve? Well, that is mind at large. And that's the second, something that Huxley coined, not Bergson, but you can use it in relation to Bergson. So for Bergson, Colors and so on exist out there. A lot of people think our brains produce colors. We've got a kind of electromagnetic wave that's not colorful, and somehow the brain magically produces color or sounds or sense. But for Bergson, those colors are actually out there in the world. The common sense view, the grass is actually green. It's not a projection, as it were. So that's mind at large in one spatial sense. In a temporal sense, like I said, the past actually exists. One's experienced past consciousness actually exists. So that's a temporal aspect of mind at large. But for Bergson, and perhaps this sort of coincides with Vedanta, well, Advaita Vedanta a little bit more, there is this kind of notion of this mind at large, or overmind, or basically a kind of godhead of some type, some kind of unified mind, which we as finite bodies are expressions of. And that's essentially almost a kind of pantheism. It's not quite pantheism for Bergson. It is probably for Vedanta or various types of it. But that's essentially what mind at large is, a kind of pantheism, that God is the universe.
And so this is a nice opportunity to segue into this kind of split between how we understand what reality is and what consciousness is. I suppose in the West, but certainly, and you see it come up in psychedelics because the experience often changes people's perception. But be useful perhaps for people who aren't familiar with it, maybe just to lay out what the difference is between sort of scientific materialism or physicalism, as it's sometimes called, and on the other side, let's say pantheism, and we can maybe get into the other versions of or different, and it's quite complicated, but just to kind of create that spectrum for people.
Yeah, well, I wrote this essay last year called "The On the Need for Metaphysics in Psychedelic Therapy and Research," and that kind of lists the five main kind of metaphysical options, as it were. It's like a metaphysics menu, because a lot of scientists, I believe that either you're a physicalist, as you say, or a dualist. But there are other options as well, and pantheism, panpsychism, kind of cross infiltrate those. So just to give out the menu very basically. So there's physicalism, there are various types, but essentially the fundamental stuff of reality is matter, hard matter or matter energy. There's dualism, which is a belief in that matter, but also a belief in mind as a separate substance that somehow comes together in organisms, or at least humans, as Descartes thought. That's kind of very common view amongst religious religions, I think. But then there are other options, like idealism, which is the view that the fundamental stuff of reality is mind, not matter. This is the view of like Berkeley, Kant, Schopenhauer, people like that, Schelling, Fichte, Hegel. And that was big in Germany, and it became big in Britain, actually, with the and America, with the absolute idealism at the end of the 19th to the beginning of the 20th century. But that was kind of shut down. So there's idealism. Then there's my preference, really, which is neutral monism. Russell coined this term, neutral monism, but it means something different now. And that's that mind and matter are just expressions of something even more fundamental, what Spinoza calls substance, nature, or God. And that is pantheism as well. So neutral monism is very much related to pantheism, which again is the view that nature or the universe is God. What do you mean by God? Not a person, really, not someone who speaks to you. Spinoza said, God does not love you, so it's something fundamentally beyond our comprehension. And then a fifth column of metaphysical option, as it were, is what you might call the transcendent. So that's the belief that beyond physicality and mentality, there exists, for example, truths of mathematics, logical truths, Plato's forms of beauty, justice, truths, and so on and so forth, moral standards. Most people don't explicitly believe in this, but if you believe in moral progress or retrogress, you're often implying that there is this exists this ideal. But what's the ontological status of those? How do they exist? That is a big philosophical question for the last 3,000 years. No agreement on it yet. But yeah, like I said, so pantheism is kind of very much related to neutral monism. Panpsychism, which is very much related to that as well, is the view that minds exist in all things. So in humans, in mice, in mycelia, but also in molecules, atoms, and beyond, and everything, plants. And this is an old view. You get it in ancient Greece, you get it in a number of great thinkers like Leibniz and Spinoza, Schopenhauer. And it's making a comeback. In the last 15 years, I'd say in academic philosophy, it's become popular again. partly because of the cul-de-sac of the hard problem of consciousness. We don't know how mind and matter relate. Nobody agrees, at least on it. So we've sort of started, gone back again to look at other solutions. How does that relate to psychedelics? Quite interestingly, because there's a lot of panpsychological reports after taking psychedelics. Chris Timmerman and his crew at Imperial College in 2021, I think, did a study which showed that people's beliefs after psychedelic experiences tend to shift from physicalism to panpsychism. That was replicated, I believe, at Johns Hopkins. So there's, very interesting. I mean, it doesn't, it's just suggestive that panpsychism relates to psychedelic experiences quite a lot. Also, I should say, panpsychism is the Western side of the coin, which in the Americas and in many indigenous communities is animism, which is also the view that their spirits inhabit trees and whatnot. I mean, this is very similar to panpsychism, not quite the same, but this is the metaphysics of many Native Americans, for example, intertwined with their psychedelic use. So I think it behoves us to look more into panpsychism in relation to psychedelic experience, not only to understand our own experiences, but also to understand other cosmologies around the world.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's something I've always thought is very important in terms of the impact psychedelics can have on our own individual mental health, but also more broadly. It's something I argue in my book, and actually, you're quoted in the among with some other philosophers, to help make that argument that shifting from seeing the world as a dead cold machine and ourselves as dead cold machines of sort of matter with a our consciousness being effectively a byproduct and a kind of living illusion, which is, I suppose, the staunchly materialist view, to what often happens with people on psychedelics. You mentioned the Imperial study and the Johns Hopkins study of people seeing the world as a living, breathing place that is conscious, and they themselves as part of that. And I think that very possibly has a huge effect on our mental health as well, because of course, why wouldn't you be depressed if you are a meaningless cog in a cold, robotic, dead universe? And anecdotally, I think anyone who's been involved with psychedelics for a while has heard these reports from people of everything is one, everything is God, all these different ways people express what they're experiencing. And now, I suppose the clinical research world is kind of catching up to those anecdotal reports, as is often the case. But what are some of the implications of a more panpsychist view? If it was rolled out, let's say more, if it, let's say, it became very popular, if someone made a few viral TikTok videos and it suddenly becomes, the dominant paradigm that we move towards, what are some of the possible implications of that?
Well, hard to predict, but I mean, I think of the Norwegian philosopher Arne Næss, who founded deep ecology, as it's known, in the 70s. And he said that our approach to nature needs to change from the kind of 20th century, well, it was really originally 17th century to 20th century physicalism, to something that appreciates that nature itself has intrinsic value as opposed to instrumental value just to us humans. This instrumental value of nature, as you kind of intimated, was really, I would say, triggered by Descartes, who thought that physicality was just pure extension, geometry almost. But that led to a number of problems and dualism, the interaction problem, and then later the hard problem of consciousness. Well, that's an old problem, really. It's just got a new name. But it doesn't really make sense, it doesn't logically or scientifically work, although physicalism is the kind of basis of much science today, if not all science. It's a metaphysical position itself, and it hides itself, it's almost like you can think, I'm not interested in metaphysics, I just go where the science leads me. But I mean, science is not neutral, it has this underlying metaphysics which influences its hypotheses and its theories and its experiments. An example of where that might change, Waddington, who was a founder of epigenetics, he based his experiments on Whitehead's metaphysics rather than sort of prevailing metaphysics, and that led to then epigenetics. But yeah, no, if we took, I mean, so Arne Næss's point about deep ecology is that, yeah, like if we consider the world then as alive, and he uses Spinoza especially to argue his case, then we will, we'll have this, we'll value it in itself. We won't see it as something to be exploited. And And perhaps this is the sort of, more longer term approach we should take to the natural world, rather than short term things, like sort of using less plastic or driving less or flying less or whatever, which of course helps, but it's still, you still have that underlying metaphysic which sort of led to the Industrial Revolution, which arguably led to the ecological crisis. But it's complicated because, Spinoza himself says, there's no need to be a vegetarian or anything like this, right? So you get into a lot of debates. But I think it's a good starting point. And the thing about panpsychism is it seems crazy to people who haven't heard about it because, we live in the West in a certain ideology, right? And if something transgresses that, we think it's completely nuts. But actually, the logic is there, and it's not anti-scientific either, If we take science to be a methodology rather than an metaphysics itself, which one should. So I think it will be very beneficial to humanity to rethink our sort of metaphysical base.
Yeah, that's my stance. My argument is that that's the our metaphysics is the generator function. So the thing generating a lot of the issues we have downstream, the sort of crisis of, including the mental health crisis, ecological crisis. So I'm in agreement with that. And on that note as well, there's something else you mentioned before, which I feel like might link to this, which is that panpsychism is sort of the West's answer to animism in some sense, and there's a crossover there. David Luke was talking in the interview we did for this conference about perspectivism, and this kind of difference between how indigenous cultures who use psychedelics learn and gather information, and how we do in the West. So could you talk a bit about that? Like, what is kind of perspectivism and that, that way of seeing the world?
Well, as I understand it, perspectivism comes from a thinker called De Castro, if that's who David was speaking about. And it's the view that in the West, we have this idea about knowledge of knowing, which is based on subject in relation to object. So we always have one perspective, as it were, the subject, and we get to know an object in terms of, generally, in terms of external properties like its size, its shape, its color, and so on and so forth, if color is external. But in the it seems that, at least according to De Castro, in indigenous communities who are animist, knowing goes beyond that, and it become knowing is becoming, right? Sounds a bit abstract, but what it means is that you get to know a being external to you, external and scare quotes, if you become it. And this is the shaman's kind of mission in many ways, to become the animal, as it were, outside and see from its eyes. I mean, De Castro takes that quite far and says that animals are persons and consider themselves to be persons in animist cultures. I mean, human persons almost. Fine, that differs from panpsychism. So, generally, I mean, there are different kinds of animism, different kinds of panpsychism, so you shouldn't generalize too much. But generally, the view of sort of panpsychism is that different cre every you know every creature has its own perspective, but they one shouldn't be anthropocentric. One shouldn't sort of project human qualities into other things. I mean, there's a famous essay in philosophy, Western philosophy, called "What Is It Like to Be a Bat?" And we can't know by just looking at the anatomy of a bat, physiology, and it could be completely alien to anything we how we perceive the world. That is a possibility. So there's no need to sort of project human qualities onto it. Not saying that it's false, but I'm just saying that that's how it differs. Another interesting thing, though, with perspectivism is this. And this relates to Bergson as well, and Whitehead to some extent. It's that the world we perceive is not just a projection of our minds, of our brains, right? It's actually an absorption. So we can become, as it were, the object. Subject and object can fuse to a certain extent. And that happens for Whitehead all the time with feelings, what he calls prehensions, and with Bergson with sympathy. And it just means that, instead of sort of inferring that someone else is feeling one way or another, happy, let's say, one actually absorbs that emotion. That emotion, as well, is not some external force to, let's say, electromagnetism. It's within, it's part of electromagnetism, which we generally don't fully understand then. And that form of panexperientialism, as it's known, which is a type of panpsychism, I say, is quite close again to this animist view of becoming, knowing by becoming. The full extent of that, though, actually becoming the object, that would be too extreme, I'd say, for the Western philosophers that I know. Again, not to say that it's wrong, but it's hard to kind of logically justify that. But anyway, the interesting thing is there's a lot of discussion to be had between Western panpsychism and indigenous animism, and that just really hasn't been carried out. And then the next step is how does that relate to psychedelic experiences, vast range of that. And then one could even go further and say, how does, as you sort of intimated again, how does that relate to mental health?
Yeah, and this always fascinates me because this is quite a common report from people who take psychedelics is becoming an animal, becoming another person. I've had experience, very convincing experience of becoming an old grandmother and having to raise three sort of seedlings, which was fascinating and really stuck with me. And it's impossible to say whether I know what it's like to be an old grandmother raising three children, but
No,
it was
that makes it,
meaningful, huh?
yeah. I just back to where we started with Huxley, right? Because in The Doors of Perception, he's got this famous line where he says he becomes the bamboo chair legs, right? Or rather, himself in them, or rather, they were in him, or rather, the one sort of process. That he says just before he goes into the Bergsonism, right? And that is also related to the reducing valve, which is that we this actual merging of subject and object can happen. Would happen were it not for our evolutionary bias to practic sort of distinguish things for practicality. But take away that practicality, that will to sort of live generally, which is very useful to us, we need it to survive. But in those occasions where we inhibit it by psychedelics and maybe even on the cusp of sleep or maybe even near-death experiences, things like this, where you inhibit practicality, then this reducing valve is open to a certain extent, and then that's when sort of the subjectivity of the object can flow in, or so it's argued.
Yeah, and here's a little maybe thought experiment that we could riff on. So, the mythologist Joseph Campbell, who wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and is famous for the hero's journey, who'd studied mythology from all around the world. He was in a hot tub in Esalen once with Stan Grof, and Stan, I believe they're in a hot tub. They're certainly at Esalen, but Grof was telling him about a patient he'd had in the Czech Republic, I think probably in the 1950s. Who had this crippling fear of death. And in his LSD experience, he encountered this sort of pig deity that he had an encounter with that helped him ultimately, I believe, to, it was part of him working through this fear of death. And Joseph Campbell said, "Oh, wow, okay, well, what did this pig goddess look like?" And Groff describes it, and he goes, "Ah, okay, that's this goddess from this tribe in Papua New Guinea that he happened to know about." And then, he'd had Groff, I think, probably sketch it out. And so he thought, okay, and it's a goddess of death, right? So these kinds of experiences people seem to report sometimes. Now, how might we make sense of something like that philosophically? What philosophy might lend itself to that being possible?
Well, it's kind of hard to find a philosopher in the Western canon who would really m make that possible. I guess some kind of pantheist, but I mean, Jung obviously comes to mind. He's a psychologist rather than a philosopher, the collective unconscious and the archetypes therein, that maybe certain archetypes are shared by all of us. The interesting philosophical question with that is, do you see that as, I mean, you can make good evolutionary sense of the fact that there are archetypes in our evolutionary past, like fear of spiders, snakes, and stuff like that. We sort of recognize a spider, recognize a snake as something to sort of avoid. That makes evolutionary sense, and we've inherited it. That's one way of looking at archetypes. The other way, though, which is a little bit more out there, is that there exists some kind of greater consciousness, greater mind in which they inhere somehow, and we access that. So it's not that we inherit it, it's rather we sort of tune into that overmind. That would be kind of an interesting form of panpsychism with archetypes therein. I don't know enough about Jung to say whether that's what he actually believed or not. But I think pantheism generally has got a lot going for it. Archetypes therein, that's pushing it. But and I can't think of any particular thinkers who would argue for that. But again, we haven't, I'm not, philosophy hasn't arrived at any kind of final conclusion, nor has science, well, nor has humanity. So all of these things are open questions, I think. And psychedelics maybe sort of point us into directions of research.
Yeah, it's I mean, Jung comes up a lot in psychedelics. I'm I wouldn't say I'm a young expert, but I certainly like his work a lot. And that, you know, makes it in a way it's even more confusing what he says about archetypes, because, you know, he says there are as many archetypes as there are kinds of human experience. So there are famously, you know, archetypes like the wise old man, or, you know, the queen, or whatever it might be, that occur a lot. But I think the way he described it, we have this collective unconscious that we each have an individual unconscious. You know, we have a conscious mind, and we have this whole sea of things happening underneath that are often driving our behavior as well. And then he said the archetypes, if you imagine that as a kind of like a swirling ocean, and very chaotic, very creative, also kind of dangerous, that the archetypes are sort of pockets of order within that. So it's just kind of swirling chaos, and they create these pockets of coherence in a kind of complex system. The weird thing is, though, why on earth would a man in the Czech Republic stumble across the archetypes of a tribe in Papua New Guinea? You know, that's the thing that I find very interesting, and, you know, perhaps suggests that if it is really the case, and it's not apocryphal, or, you know, that there's some kind of non-local consciousness, so that our consciousness is shared beyond just our, you know, little old me sitting in the Czech Republic. I'm somehow connected to a greater sort of, I suppose, mind at large in some way.
Yeah, this is the interesting question. I mean, especially today with the so-called 4E theories of cognition, like extended embodied mind and so on, and activism, which is the basic question is consciousness fully endogenous or exogenous? Does it come from within, or does it come from without, or is there a mixture, which seems more likely at the very least? You know, the reason we don't know the answer to this scientifically, right, is because I think that one of the properties of mind generally is a certain extent of privacy, right? Or it's called the problem of other minds in philosophy, that you can't, you know, you can look at my brain and whatever, but you can't directly perceive with your five senses, at least, my toothache or whatever it may be, right? That's kind of, you can guess it, you can infer it, but you can't be sure. You can't feel it. And as a result, we can't see empirically whether the brain is necessary and sufficient for consciousness, right? By which I mean, we can see that mentality is correlated to brain activity. No one questions that, actually, although it's actually trickier than people believed 20 years ago, even. So they haven't fully mapped that. And maybe you can't generalize it. Maybe different people have different correlates, you know. But we can't see how that mind is related. We can only see that it is related, but not how. So maybe you know, the mind picks up stuff, and that causes the correlation. Maybe it produces stuff, and that causes the correlation. Maybe it is the stuff, right? I don't mind second neural identity theory, and that's thus the correlation. So the correlation itself can sort of point to many different causes, many different conditions, many different metaphysical viewpoints. It in itself, it's not sufficient to prove a particular metaphysical point. So the question, I think, is open as to whether we sort of absorb or produce consciousness. And there are good arguments for both, and the good arguments against both, and that sort of rages on.
Yeah, and so yeah, and I mean I could talk about this all day, but there's other things I'd love to get onto. And specifically, I want to talk a little bit about your paper and around the importance of metaphysics and psychedelic therapy, because I think this is something that's often really left out. No one asks you, even, you know, having been a healthy volunteer on a trial, no one asked me what's your view on reality before I went in, which I think they should, because you're going to have an experience that radically changes it. You should have a sense of what's the baseline. So why, you know, in your view, why is it important that, you know, within the clinical therapeutic side of psychedelics, people are considering metaphysics?
Well, the very basic point is that if you want to integrate a metaphysical experience, you should have recourse to metaphysics, right? Which is almost true by definition, tautology. You can classify a number, not all, but a number of psychedelic experiences as metaphysical, like we said, panpsychological, pantheist, idealist, whatever. But the reason that these experiences are not really properly analyzed and spoken about and integrated is because of, I mentioned to you that like 20, 30 years ago, there was this metaphysical turn in the West, which is a return to metaphysics. So, and I think this bears on it, because in the so In Britain, in the English-speaking world at least, there was a so-called British ideal or absolute idealism, which was quite very sort of a pantheistic view in many ways, kind of based on Hegel and Plato and Kant and so on. And then there was this massive swing against it from logical, what we call the logical positivists and the logical behaviorists and so on. And people like A.J. Eyre, the great British philosopher, he said, you know, like metaphysics completely meaningless, completely nonsense. And there was this massive shift away from it in general culture. And I think that psychology originally, if you read psychology and William James's Principles of Psychology, 1890, a lot of it is kind of philosophy of mind. He himself was a metaphysician. His last book was about Fechner, Bergson, and Hegel. But there was this turn away from metaphysics in general, but especially in sciences and psychology. And so psychology developed without the supposed need for metaphysics, especially in English-speaking worlds, and the continent less so. I mean, you still do sort of philosophy in schools on the European continent, but not here. And as a result, psychologists and we see it today, you know, they can't make heads or tails of these metaphysical experiences. They don't know how to classify them. They don't know that there's a huge legacy of Western thought about them from very good thinkers and mathematicians, scientists. I mean, the distinction between science and philosophy only happened in the 1830s or so. But now when we realize that, you know, actually metaphysics isn't meaningless, and in fact, the people who said that had their own metaphysics and are sort of really trying to smuggling in. Trying to smuggle in their own metaphysics as a universal. When we're now more open-minded to how mind and matter relate again, the metaphysics of mind, I think we can sort of open up to the possibility that this might be useful for understanding certain psychedelic experiences. So this is the case I made in that paper from last year. And that's been factor analyzed now. It's about to be validated and it's going to be used in certain trials now. So you know, I
Right.
look forward to it. Also, there's a course I'm starting in Colorado, training practitioners in metaphysics, and I've got a deal with Bloomsbury to publish this metaphysics manual, which will sort of lay out all the sort of, you know, metaphysical positions in as intelligible a manner as possible. So it's not an undergrad textbook, it's for philosophy students, it's going to be for practitioners and the public.
Excellent. Pop science, my realm. Yeah, I love that. That's great. And it feels very important. I wrote an essay last year called The Ego Doesn't Die, which is a very provocative title. Arguing against this concept of ego death, which is very widespread in psychedelic worlds as a sort of thing to attain. And I think there's this legacy of understanding the mystical experience only through an Eastern lens, which came about, I think, because of the researchers in the 60s living through that era where there was a rediscovery of Eastern philosophy, a lot of them being into Zen, etc. And so even today, when you do a psychedelic trial, if you do the metaphysical beliefs questionnaire that Imperial developed, what they're looking for is
They're
largely looking for that kind of metaphysical experience of dissolving and becoming one with everything. But when you look at people's reports of metaphysical experiences and mystical experiences, there's a huge range. Sometimes you become the universe, sometimes you have an overview effect, like I've experienced that of being like astronauts looking at the Earth from space, being tiny in comparison to the vastness of the cosmos. So there's this huge range, and I think it's a really exciting time to be exploring that now.
Yeah, I mean, one of the criticisms of understanding mystical experiences as unitive from Stephen Katz in the 70s was that unity can mean many things. You know, it can mean the unity of subject and object, the unity of person present, the unity of mind and matter, unity of God and nature, and so on. So, yeah, I think we have to be much more careful with these words. I mean, those you say that, yeah, like in the 60s, people looked to the East. I mean, this is, yeah, partly because that was becoming popular then, especially thanks to D.T. Suzuki, who was kind of introducing a lot of Buddhism, Vedanta to the West. But also, I think it's because, like I said, you know, like Western metaphysics, academic metaphysics was frowned upon, and so we couldn't draw upon that. We couldn't get Western philosophers to talk about it, you know. So we had to sort of go to the East instead, because that was the only availability then, as it were. Even though Huxley did try with Bergson, like I said, but Bergson at the time was considered one of these sort of meaningless metaphysicians from people at Russell. Although Russell, I must say, he wrote Mysticism and Philosophy, this great essay about the mystical experience, and he had one himself. So I'm not completely dismissing his thought. But anyway, yeah, no. What can I say? I mean, I think the Western world has a particular metaphysics when you can trace the history of that quite easily from the well, the West had sort of Aristotelian metaphysics until the sort of 16th, 17th centuries. Then we, in the Scientific Revolution, we took on this mechanistic form of metaphysics from people like, especially, Descartes, Galileo, Bacon to a certain extent. And that sort of infused itself in our way of thinking. And it was very, useful, practical for technology, industry. But it kind of got rid of consciousness. And 20th century saw an upsurge in that after a little blip with absolute idealism. But still, we're at this cul-de-sac, the hard problem of consciousness. How does mind and matter relate? We just don't know. We just can't explain it according to that particular metaphysics, which therefore you can see as a falsification of Western metaphysics, right? So the mind-matter mystery as falsification of Western materialism. I mean, people don't see it like that. They say this is a problem that science will work out eventually, But I think, well, if science changes radically, then it could, but then it won't be science as we understand it. So therefore, we have to look elsewhere, and thus we have to be more open-minded to the experiences we have in psychedelics, metaphysical experiences. They might not all be delusions, hallucinations. Some are, no doubt, but not all necessarily.
And it feels like, with more and more scientists getting interested in psychedelics, who knows if that might have a trickle down or maybe trickle up effect on the scientific paradigm in general. So one can only hope. So Peter, thank you very much. This has been fascinating.
Thank you, Alexander. It's been very fascinating for me too.